This episode is presented by The Brooklyn Kitchen. Learn more at brooklynkitchen.com.
Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And thank you.
Hey, gang, just a reminder, I will be recording a live show at the Food Media Lab at the San Francisco Cooking School on Tuesday, June 18th from 7 to 9 p.m. If you're in San Francisco, please join us for my one-on-one conversation with Chef Preeti Mistry and a tribute to the late Judy Rogers of Zuni Cafe featuring five chefs who worked with her. And on Saturday, June 22nd, join me and Chefs David Waltuck and Claudia Fleming for a 1980s dinner at the Chef's Garden in Ohio. For tickets and information on both, click on the bio line at our Instagram feed at Chef Podcast, or visit the events page on my blog, tokeland.com/appearances.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
Do you miss being on the line? Do you miss being in a kitchen?
I miss the camaraderie, of course. I miss the lack of bullshit, because you can't bullshit in the kitchen. You know, you can't talk about yourself. You can't inflate yourself, because everyone will know tomorrow.
Right.
I like living in a pure meritocracy.
Yeah.
I like that first cold beer after work. I like hanging with cooks and people who work for a living.
Yeah.
Who prove their mettle. Men and women who prove their mettle every day, every hour.
Yeah.
If they say they're going to do a thing, do a thing.
Yeah.
Or they're not, or they're quickly no longer in your orbit.
Right.
But I had 28 years of it.
Yeah.
I don't delude myself into thinking that I'd be useful. I'd be a liability.
Yeah.
I was in decline already at 44. I mean, Kitchen Confidential was very good timing for me, as it turned out.
Right, right.
Cooking is fucking hard. People just, they pretend to acknowledge, people who don't do it for a living pretend to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
But they don't know.
That is, of course, the late Anthony Bourdain and a conversation from 2014 that we've never shared before, but are now as we observe and cope with the anniversary of his death on a special episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am here today. You're like our recurring, you are to us what Joan Rivers was to the Tonight Show before the falling out, the famous falling out with Johnny Carson. Julia Sexton of Edible Westchester and a writer in her own right. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrew.
Thank you for joining me for this.
This is always fun.
It is always fun. I mean, I thought when I was even saying, like, welcome to the show, like, this is a grim anniversary, but we've all had a year. I don't think we need to play it up. I mean, we're all still very sad. I think we always will be. But we lost Anthony Bourdain a year ago this week. And I had totally forgotten about it, but I had done, at the same sit-down over a lunch 5 years ago, two interviews back-to-back. One was for my blog, and one was for my book. And you know, they weren't ever, they were all on the record. Nothing, not one word was off the record. He never said, you can't print what I'm about to tell you. But this was before I'd ever done a podcast. I was recording with my little lousy Sony reporter's mic, you know, digital recorder, you know, set down at the table in a loud restaurant. The audio is not great, but you know, he was great. It was a great interview, mainly because of him. I mean, it's almost embarrassing for me to play it now because I've gotten much better at what I do. You know, I played with the sound, but I just thought, you know, a year later, to hear an hour plus with him that people haven't heard, I thought maybe listeners, especially to this show, would like to do it.
Absolutely. I mean, everything that he said, you know, at this point, now that he's gone, is precious. So, you know.
Yeah. And I was torn about running it because it technically wasn't an audio interview. And I, you know, I think if the two responses I think he probably would have had were fine or I don't give a shit. Do whatever you want with it.
Right.
Like, honestly, I really do believe that. In any event, before we get to that, and you and I are going to chat a little bit, but I will say, I have to acknowledge a few things. First of all, we lost Leah Chase over the weekend.
Yeah.
A legend. This is a, you know, obviously I'm sad that we lost her, but I always remembered my maternal grandfather died, and much younger than, I mean, she was almost 100.
Yeah, she was ancient.
Yeah, my maternal grandfather died, and someone in my family at the time referred to it as a tragedy. And I remember my father saying to me, you know, we're all going to go. Mm-hmm. You get up into your 80s, 90s, like, and go having led a good life, you know, and done what you set out to do. It's not tragic. I mean, we're going to miss her. I amazingly never got to meet her. But I think it's a moment to just celebrate, reflect
Absolutely.
On this incredible life. I mean, she got a lot of time on this earth and kind of wrung maximum value out of it.
Absolutely.
And for people, I can't get too into it on this show, but you know, if you don't know who Leah Chase is, as I often say with certain legendary figures, you know, get thee to the internet and
yeah.
read up on Leah Chase. She's
yeah.
a major, major figure in American culinary history. You know, on a much less significant note in the scheme of things, I was at the last service of Barbuto last week. I wrote a piece about it for salon.com if anyone's interested. I need to wish a bon voyage from New York City to my buddy Aaron Bluthorn, who was the chef until Friday night of Cafe Balut.
Wow.
So the night after my last dinner at Barbuto, I went to my last service of Aaron Bluthorn at Cafe Balut. He's moving to Texas, and he'll be announcing his plans there, I think. On a less melancholy note, I was at the 5th anniversary bash for Batard Restaurant. Marcus Glocker was just on the show a few weeks ago.
Right.
Drew Naporin and John Winterman are the front of house or hospitality people behind that. Marcus, of course, is the chef. That was quite an event. It's been a crazy 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, you've been busy.
I've been busy. And then I was at the Welcome Conference yesterday, the conference that the great Will Gadara and Brian Canlis and Anthony Rudolph put on.
I saw that.
And that was, as always, there's not a lot of calls to action at that conference. There were a few this year. I would describe that conference, I think it's intent. I've never discussed this at length with the guys, but I think it's to inspire. Like, I'm not in the front or back of the house as Sherry Bayer, who's another host on Heritage, said to me, we live on the side of the house.
We live in the audience.
In the audience. But it's always an inspirational day. The speakers were incredible. Anyway, I just wanted to mention all of those things before we get to Tony. My segue, Julia, and by the way, Julia, as always, is kind of like, you know, I've sent up the bat signal. I think I called you at 10 o'clock last night.
It was pretty late.
Yeah. And I was like, I'm editing this show. I want to get it right. I don't know what I want to say till I edit it. Caitlin has now just like will not do morning interviews because she has to take a 6:30 train to work.
That's tough.
I don't blame her.
That's tough.
And I called you and said, like, help. And also, I know Anthony had a very important place in your life and career.
Yeah, I was on the edge until he said, well, it's about Bourdain. And, you know.
Okay, well, that's honest. Thank you for that.
Well, because it's so early.
Yeah, I know. I felt bad.
I still live restaurant hours.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so here I want to, as a segue, I've had a very, I don't know what I would call it, emotionally potent in good and bad ways, in profound ways, couple of weeks. I've been to a lot of events. I feel like more and more people have found this show. Mm-hmm. You know, I was at dinner at the new Maison Yaki, the new restaurant from the Olmsted guys in Brooklyn, and I was eating at a counter, and somebody who I thought was eavesdropping the whole night leans over finally and says, I'm a chef in Pittsburgh, and I recognized your voice.
That's fun.
You know, people at the LA Chef Conference kind of knew who I was. It's very weird for me. I'm only saying all this because it actually ties in with several thoughts I had about Anthony and about what I think had to for him, you know, having his big break in, well into his 40s, having struggled with heroin addiction and not having been a very distinguished chef, which he was very honest about. He talks about it in this interview.
No, he was a ham and egger.
His life, in a surreal way, I think, changed in ways that he rarely let on, but I almost can't imagine it. But here's the note I wanted to read. We got an iTunes review the other day. And I'm not going to say the guy's name because it's a handle. You know, it's like an Instagram iTunes handle. But here's the note, and it'll be clear why I'm... And this ties into several themes in this interview. I'm a 20-plus year vet of the chef world, and I fall into the many trappings talked about on this show being this podcast. Growing up, as many chefs did, with some form of learning disability... and not really knowing what it was or why. I myself fell into sports and cooking because that's where I felt I belonged most. They were both an outlet for anger, aggression, and creativity.
Yeah.
Being dyslexic, I have quite literally never had the ability to sit and read a book like a normal person. Now, whenever someone uses the word normal about others, it makes me very sad.
Right.
I think that's a failing of our society.
There is no normal.
There is no normal. The advent of the podcast never really appealed to me at first until I started discovering professional food-based shows. He says some nice stuff about me that I'm not going to read because I'm not trying to be self-promotional. Thanks to the likes of Instagram, we all know a lot about people, but don't really know them at all. What Andrew does by diving into so many different chefs' lives makes this show a very special one. It allows you to get to know the people you often hear about better. Now, here's why I'm reading this. But most importantly, for someone like me and many others, it gives us a new avenue to learn beyond having to read, which when we can't do it well. It has also shown many of us that there are some really talented people in our industry that have suffered the same way and have persevered.
Yeah.
And then he says some other stuff about me that I'm not going to read. Okay, so Tony and I actually, 5 years ago, sitting at a table at the Breslin restaurant, you're going to hear it, people are going to hear it in a minute, talked about this. You know, he said that there were a lot of cooks who had come up to him over the years and said they had never read a book since high school.
It's really true.
Except for Kitchen Confidential.
It was hurtful to me in the beginning as a writer, you know, like, what do you mean you didn't read it? Oh, well, I don't read.
Well, that's a thing.
Yeah.
You know, I remember as a kid being in a store, the local Five and Dime near my home in Coral Gables, Florida. And this older gentleman came up to me and he asked, oh, can you help me? You're about my daughter's age. Can you help me pick out a birthday card for her? And I realized the guy couldn't read I was showing, you know, I realized. And, that's not something people want to cop to. And it's not even that they can't read words. It's more sometimes it is, but oftentimes you can't string them together. You don't have the attention,
don't have the attention span
to sit and focus on more than a paragraph.
And cooking fosters that shortened attention span.
Yeah, it works for people, right? So, but I thought this was a good segue into talking about Anthony Bourdain. Mm-hmm. So why don't you, Julia, you used to be a cook.
Yep.
You are now very successfully a writer. When he died... last year, I think you tweeted something to the effect of that he showed you that the transition from one to the other was possible.
Yeah, you know, he was, you know, as you say, there's no normal. I was a very bookish cook, you know.
Yeah.
I was a reader, and so was he.
Yep.
And he showed me that you could come from this kind of sweaty, kind of working class, kind of scar-inducing world.
Right.
And write for The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he did. He wrote for The New Yorker.
Yeah.
And he wrote kind of funky little crime novels. And he wrote an amazing piece of new journalism, which was his Typhoid Mary piece that absolutely blew the hat off my head. It was so good.
And why don't you explain? I've actually read that book, but the thesis of that book was what? Because it's something most people just know that name, Typhoid Mary.
Right. She was an Irish-American cook who became notorious for having... She was a carrier of typhoid, never actually had the disease, was merely a carrier. And she was imprisoned on North Brother Island in the East River because she refused to not practice her trade.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, history has frowned on this woman. Bourdain reexamined her life going to the rocky, cold shores of North Brother Island to look at where they imprisoned her, talked about what life was like for an Irish cook during this time.
Yeah, and he said cooks don't miss work, right? That was part of the thesis of the book, was that part of the reason this all happened was the ethos of the cooking trade. The fucked up ethos in some ways. I mean, it's great to you know, Mike Anthony tells a story. It's no secret that he had a heart situation years ago and almost died because he had all these signs that something was really bad was happening in his chest.
Right. But he couldn't miss work.
Well, he was the chef, and his people actually had to say to him, like, you need to go to the hospital. Like, he was clearly in something was wrong, right? And that saved his life.
Right.
Right? It's all very laudable until people start dying, you know?
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely true. I think what the big thing with Typhoid Mary was that she was what people don't understand is that she was a very skilled cook that worked hard to achieve those skills. He examined the food that she would be serving and also discussed that the only work she was offered after that was to be a laundress.
Right. Yeah. Right. So which speaks again to where the profession sort of was in society. This also comes up in this interview that we're about to play. What else for you personally? Like over the years, it's funny. There's an interview with Jeremiah Tower we're going to run in a few weeks. And spoiler alert, but Bourdain produced
this
movie, The Last Magnificent, about Tony, about Jeremiah. And, I was talking with Jeremiah about Bourdain, who Jeremiah knew him a lot better than I ever did. But, I said, it's funny when you see early footage of him, like on a Cook's Tour, and then you see footage of him, in his last years, a lot of people physically actually do shrink a little as they get older. He seemed to grow as he got old. His hands look bigger.
Yeah.
His head looks bigger. And Jeremiah said he seemed a foot taller. Like when you go back and look at a Cook's Tour, he looks a little, I'm just describing it. I don't think he wouldn't care. Again,
maybe
I don't.
Maybe they shot him differently.
I think he looked a little runty. He looked too skinny. Like he was always fit, right? But he looked too skinny. He slouched a little.
Yeah.
He just looked a little like a little punk, which he kind of was.
Yeah.
And a very eloquent one.
Yeah.
But and then by the end he was like this.
He became fitter too. I mean,
Well, yeah, he was doing the whatever kickboxing or martial arts. I don't know exactly what it was, but he it was crazy. He seemed like to go in the, it was like it was in a way, there was this Benjamin Button aspect to how he aged.
Right.
Yeah. In any event. A couple of things I need to say to orient people. One is, this is a two-part interview. The backstory is, I would never have thought to do this, but a mutual friend who I don't want to name, but somebody who was very instrumental in his publishing life, and I'm very friendly with this person, said to me, why haven't you had an interview with Tony on your blog? And I said, well, I would never ask him to do this blog. I don't even know how many people listen to this show know I have a blog. There's good reasons for it. I abandoned it for like months at a time. And she said, no. And basically, she kind of described the dynamic, right? She didn't use this term, but it was almost like describing that pretty girl that no one wants to ask to the prom, so nobody does.
She's like, you
should ask him. You know, you guys have met. You guys get along. So I wrote him a note, and like in 2 seconds, he had copied Lori Wolliver, who most people know was his longtime aide de camp. We made an appointment to get together, and So one part of the interview was for the blog, and I did run part of it, just a fraction, in print. Mm-hmm. The other part was I was working on my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll at the time. He was around at that time, but he was really on the edges. And this, again, comes up. It gets a little awkward in the interview because I'm asking him about people like Jonathan Waxman and Alfred Portale and Ann Rose. And he didn't really know any of those people. He wasn't in their circle. They didn't know who he was. He mentions he went to Blue Ribbon in the early days when it was a chef hangout.
Right.
And he never got asked to any of like the cool tables. It's kind of amazing where he ended up.
But
you know,
that's sort of where his humanity came from, was that he wasn't the cool guy, or, you know, he wasn't exactly the celebrity chef. He had a much more gimlet-eyed view of that world.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I don't think he ever forgot. You know, there was an article
in
Publishers Weekly years ago did a piece about why does every book seem to have a foreword by Anthony Bourdain. And he said, look, I was a starving writer at one point, and I remember what that's like. So when people, it's kind of the way cooks are or chefs are with each other. It was kind of like We Chef.
Yeah.
You know, if a writer asked him for a foreword or advice, he gave it.
Yeah.
You know, and honestly, he did that with me. I always point out we didn't go out to dinner. He wasn't like my buddy. Mm. If I needed something, he would respond and help me, you know. I thought that was very special at the time. But, like, you know, after he died, there were all these stories of people no one's ever heard of.
Oh, yeah.
And he did that for a lot of people. It's kind of astonishing.
His assistant wrote this,
Lori.
Yeah,
Lori Wolliver.
Wrote this amazing thing about how, you know, most of these assistant stories are about being abused by your boss.
Yeah,
and in fact, she was treated wonderfully.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, and she's great. I think that's on CNN.com. I think it was.
I don't know. I read the piece. And
I think she wrote it for CNN.com.
I always thought,
You always thought?
I always thought that that's how you tell the true nobility of a person is, you know, how they treat the people who are, you know, less...
Who can't fight back.
Yeah, who can't fight back.
I just said this in an interview yesterday at the Welcome Conference. Kat Kinsman was interviewing people, and she said, what's the responsibility of a restaurant customer? And I said, you know, to not be an asshole, basically. Yeah. Like, you're not, you know...
Fundamental decency.
You
don't have to get crazy.
Yeah, but I made the point. I said, you know, nothing will turn me off to a person almost irreparably than people who talk or who treat people who can't push back.
It's so true.
Waiters.
I have fired friends for bad restaurant behavior.
Fired friends, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you suddenly realize, God, this person's... asshole.
Now, if you know, to antagonize the defenseless
or shame. Or,
it's just to me the lowest thing you can do.
100%.
It's horrible. This again, I think he never let go of knowing what it felt like to be on the edges, you know, or to need help. You know, the fact that he. So here's the thing. I spoke to. I mean, this is on her show also, but. I had this revelation recently, and I talked about this at the beginning of the show, and I read that review. I have had this little, I don't know, this new, there's this new dimension of my life, which is more people know who I am and what I do. Mm-hmm. I have cooks coming to me a lot for advice, which is an honor. It's hard to give, to be there for people. You know, I want to give people attention. I want to meet them for a coffee.
Yeah,
I want to talk to them on the phone.
Yeah, yeah.
There's people who I've gone from messaging on Instagram. There's a listener out there named Rob. Rob, I don't want to say your last name, but you know who you are. We've moved it over to texting, you know, but I still haven't gotten on the phone with this guy. I will. Okay. Tony was world freaking famous, and yet he would do this for people. And
just pick up the phone?
Well, I don't know how often he picked up the phone, but I, as far as I can tell, he would respond to people. Someone told a story, I forget, it was right after the, all these stories that came out where he had scribbled his phone number like on their notebook or something and said, get in touch, let's do this thing.
Yeah, such humility.
But you know? I don't know how he had enough of himself to do that.
Well, maybe he ran out, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think most of us know what really happened there. But, I mean, I'm not saying it wasn't a suicide, but I don't know what the context was. I don't know how long-suffering he was. I think a lot of people who really don't know were making a lot of assumptive leaps at the time.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine how he managed to give as much as he gave to people. And I will tell you, there's a moment, they did a Parts Unknown about his impact. And there's a moment late at night where I don't even know where it was because it was a montage show, you know, of clips from all these.
Yep.
And he goes up to some late night outside bar somewhere and just walks up. And this is Tony Bourdain, right? And he's like, and there's some chef cooks there and he's like, gentlemen. And like, you felt like that's probably exactly how he's sidled up to a table like that when no one knew who he was, right?
It just fit right in.
But he still had that affection for colleagues, what he thought of as still colleagues of the kitchen, right? And he never got too big for that, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway.
That's laudable.
To all you listeners out there, you know, again, I wrestled with airing this. I don't want it to seem like self-promotional, you know? I for the record, I mentioned my book. It comes up in passing as I'm asking him questions in the second half of this show. Don't go buy my book this week. Buy Typhoid Mary or buy one of Tony's, buy Medium Raw if you never read that. Or honestly, I don't know that you should pick up one of his novels. They weren't that great. There's a reason that those came before. He got published before Kitchen Confidential.
Yeah.
And nobody knew it. I maybe don't pick those up.
If you're obsessive, there's Juvenilia, you know.
Yeah, if you're a completist.
Yeah, I am.
Completist.
So I read them all.
Yes, but, you know, just for the record, I'm not pushing my own thing. Go buy a Tony Bourdain book this week.
Typhoid Mary.
Typhoid Mary is a scholarly work.
Oh, I love it so much.
That's entertaining.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's a profound work of new journalism.
That's well put. Okay, a couple of things I need to say. We sat down for this interview, April 29, 2014. That's just a little over 5 years ago. It feels much longer. We had lunch at the Breslin. He very kindly, and I told this story last year, and incidentally, episode 35 of this series, the day the news broke about Tony, spontaneously sat down with Bill Telepan in his kitchen and we talked for half an hour. If you want to go through the archives of this show, you can listen to that. It's very raw. We didn't edit it. There's no music or anything. We just literally recorded it and I sent it from his restaurant to the station or to Heritage and they threw it up on air. But if you want to hear some thoughts on that day, that's available for your consumption. We had just watched the movie Chef together because he had a friendship with Roy Choi, who had consulted on that movie.
Right.
We had watched it in the screening room at 0.0. And then we went to the Breslin and we did this interview. Again, it's two parts. Just to orient you, Tony was already doing Parts Unknown. He had just aired that week an episode where he had gone to Lyon with Daniel Boulud, who's from Lyon. They had spent time with Paul Bocuse, which was a very momentous occasion in Tony's life. I'm bringing this up because we talk about all these things in the interview. He alludes to some friends by the first name. I don't think he ever mentions last names, but Eric is obviously Eric Repair, who was his best friend.
The Ripper.
Jose is Jose Andres, who needs no introduction. Amazingly, and Julia, this is the second time it's come up when you have been with me, he refers to Mario.
Yeah.
That is Mario Batali. As you and I have said here before, let us not judge people who were in the presence of Mario Batali years ago, because most people of Tony's generation were.
Yeah.
If you were in that generation in New York, you spent time with Mario socially. So, and Tony said things after the fact. That's not what this show is about. But when he refers to Mario, that's who Mario is.
I think there's a passing reference made to the Market Project. That, of course, was what was supposed to be the Bourdain Market.
Right.
As I say that, I might have edited it out, but I'm not sure. Anyway, if there's a reference to the market, that's what that was. And I don't know. I think that's all I need to say about all this. The one other thing I will say is, I said it at the beginning, it was humbling for me to listen to this, first of all, because, again, you know, he gave me 90 minutes of his life, you know, which I don't know where it came from. I don't know where it came from. I don't know how he had it to give. I don't think my interviewing skills are on particularly good display here, but that's,
well, you were
I don't,
interviewing for print.
It was for print, right? Yeah, I was never thinking this was going to air.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing about it, I will say, is that, you know, I just listened to Mark Maron the other day interview David Letterman. Mm-hmm. And we talk in this interview, I talk with Tony about, you know, we were talking about Bocuse, and I say, well, you know, I won't give the answers in right now, but you'll hear them. You know, who else for you would be in that realm of Paul Bocuse? You know, who would be,
right,
like, just hard for you to be cool around? And he had a list, you know, even Tony Bourdain had a list.
That's so funny.
But for me, in the culinary industry, there was only one person who occupied that place for me, who even in my 40s made me feel like a little starstruck, you know, kid. It was Tony Bourdain.
Me too.
He's the only... Did you ever meet him?
Yes.
Did you tell him what he meant to you?
I did.
What did he say?
It was a total cringe. I handed him my book to sign, yeah, and he was with Fergus Henderson.
Oh, jeez.
And yeah, and I was pretty much a liquid substance at that point. I don't remember. Yeah. And I think I just blathered on about, God knows, I'm cringing at the thought. But he took time to, like, 10 minutes to make this drawing of a knife. And it said, cook free or die, and had dripping off it. It went on.
Yes.
And this drawing went on and on.
Yes, that's
and,
the knife.
And Fergus Henderson was sort of rolling his eyes that this was taking so long. But he was very kind.
Yeah, he was amazing. He was,
but yeah, that was the only guy that made me, he was the only person that I really sort of choked up around.
Yeah. I mean, I was very nervous with him, mm-hmm, you know, and I think, cause I have peers who were, you know, really got to know him, and they talked to him on the phone, and I just think I could never get past what he meant to me. And I actually think that was, I don't want to use the word fault, but I think I created a dynamic that made that impossible.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, and I wouldn't blame him
with that.
Yeah, I think he got it, and I just don't think that's the kind of person he wanted to have a beer with. But I think if I had been a little more confident and a little less whatever, that I probably would have gotten to know him better. But that's fine. He was amazing. And okay, this is a very long intro, but I think it's appropriate. And with that, guys, I hope I've said everything I need to say to orient you in time and space to where we were when this happened. But this was my interview, part one of it, with the late, amazing Anthony Bourdain, recorded April 29th, 2014, at the Breslin Restaurant, over lunch and a couple of beers. Here you go.
You write. You've got the show. You've got an imprint. This all started with a New Yorker article, yeah, and a book.
Yeah.
When you think back to, you know, the article, book, things kind of snowballing, what was the tipping point for you when you really started to understand that you were kind
something
of...
Something was happening. Gonna, right?
That it was turning into, your life was transforming into what it's become.
About 6 months after it happened, I mean, I guess I assumed I was on the bestseller list. I signed for the television, the book and the television series, A Cook's Tour. People were calling me and offering me all sorts of wonderful things. But I was still very much working under the assumption that it's all bullshit and it will all vaporize and that I should keep my day job. So I was
when
still
you say
working.
Thought bullshit, you mean you didn't trust it?
I didn't
you
trust
people
it.
Were bullshit?
No, I didn't trust it.
It seemed too good to be true?
Yes. Well, I still kind of believe that. But I thought it could all
as these things do.
Yeah.
When you're talking to television or movie people, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, these things tend to vaporize.
Yeah.
I knew enough by then. I was 44. I assume, and who believes that you can make a living writing?
Right.
You know, that's already.
Yeah.
You know, I spent my life with waiters who wanted to be writers or wanted to be actors.
Sure.
So I very much felt that this is all great.
Yeah.
I'm going to make the most of it while I can, but yeah. I'm not going to be so foolish as to think that I should quit my job.
Right.
I finally had a job that I was good at.
Right.
Where I was appreciated, and we were actually a successful restaurant,
yeah.
which was just about a first for me in my entire 30-year career.
Yeah.
Leal was really the first time that I was working for a restaurant that was busy before me, busy during me, and would be busy after me.
Yeah.
And I was very aware of that. I was on a good thing. I was happy.
Yeah.
So it took me about 6 months. And then from that point on, I have been careful. I've been very careful. I, on one hand, have tried to make the most of it,
yeah.
of my opportunities, but I've been very careful about what I say yes to and what I say no to.
Yeah.
And I think seriously always about, look, this may be a good idea right now, or it may be a lot of money right now, but will it be good for me 5 years from now?
Right.
Will it be fun? Will it make me hate myself? Will I? I think about all of those things.
Can I ask you? You may, if you'd rather, I didn't bring it up. Just tell me.
No, anything
I didn't
is fine.
Ask you. But you know, I first met you when we were promoting "Don't Try This at Home."
Yeah.
And we all went to dinner at Lupa.
Yeah.
And at that time, the Kitchen Confidential TV show with Bradley Cooper.
Yeah.
Was on, and my wife said to you, "What's your involvement with the show?" And you laughed and said, "When they air one, they send me a check."
Yeah.
But I sort of privately have always thought that it seemed to me from the timing of it that you actually maybe took something out of that, that you became more careful what your name was.
I knew
was
beforehand.
Put on.
No, I knew beforehand. They were paying me as a consultant. I think largely when they do that,
yeah.
they don't really want you to consult. They want to pay you to not badmouth your own project.
Right.
I had very low. Remember, that project was sold initially to be a David Fincher film with Brad Pitt.
I had that to ask you. I remember that.
So, but I had low.
Was it the same producers who took it over to television?
No. Look, I had low expectations when I sold the thing.
Yeah.
It was not an unpleasant experience working with Darren Starr.
Yeah.
To the extent that I did, which was, I think we had lunch once.
Yeah.
Went out to the studio. I never saw the. Yeah, I saw the set before they actually showed up, but I never was on set or anything like that. I had low expectations. I mean, you sell your baby to Hollywood, you get what everybody gets, you know?
Right.
I got out easy. I didn't, because I had no expectations. I wasn't brokenhearted when it turned into something else. I mean, it was a half-hour sitcom on Fox. What the fuck do I expect?
Right.
You know, and in retrospect, it's something of a historical curiosity. You know, I haven't seen it in many years, but... you know, I didn't go hide in a closet when it came out.
Sure.
I just, when I looked at it, I didn't think that's me. I never expected it. What did they do to my book? It wasn't my book. The minute I sold it to Hollywood, it's not my book. So, it was not an unpleasant experience, and it didn't scar me or mark me in any way. My attitude towards these things was reasonably healthy before that experience and remains that way. I have a pretty good idea of how these things work.
Yeah. When you were writing Kitchen Confidential, what was your ambition for that book? Was it just to write?
I wanted the guys in my kitchen and a bunch of other kitchens in New York to find it funny.
Yeah.
And to say that's not bullshit. Well, that's like our life. That's this guy. You know, he's one of us. That's it. It was it. I wrote it for the New York Press, essentially, the paper of the New York Press. I wrote that first article, and I expanded on it for the book.
Yeah.
I really, really, really didn't think that... I didn't understand or see any reason for anyone as far west as Philadelphia to read it.
Right.
So it all came as a surprise to me. I mean, it's in like 30 languages.
Yeah.
It was very quickly in that many languages. And no clue. I mean, it's so New York-centric, you know, the whole fish on Monday, the whole... All of these rules were very much, you know, 1998 in New York.
Yeah.
I didn't see how any of that would translate. I never thought for a minute. I never for a second considered what people might want out of a book.
Yeah.
Or what they might expect, or whether this would translate to,
yeah,
to another city.
Right.
I just didn't think about those things. I was given an opportunity to... I wrote an article wanting to sell it for $100 to the New York Press. It ended up in the New Yorker. I got offered a book on the basis of that, so I just did more of that.
Yeah.
Because it seemed to work and it was fun.
Right.
I had the luxury of not having any idea what was expected or understanding of it or even.
Awesome.
Thank you. I would have been paralyzed with fear and uncertainty if I'd had any clue what the reading public wanted.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have known what to do.
It seemed to me, I mean, I remember very well when that book came out. You know, it's funny, I actually, for me, I kind of make a connection to what White Heat was, you know, in that it was showing, you know, a lot of times when you would read about chefs or read cookbooks, there was this sort of idealized presentation of the life. Like the kitchen, the professional kitchen almost went away. You never really read about it.
Right.
I felt like the photographs of White Heat were important in that respect. And I feel like your book was sort of the prose equivalent of that. Did you connect?
I looked at, White Heat was, I wanted to be that guy. We all did. We saw Marco leaning against the wall smoking a cigarette. We all connected with that. My God, it's a chef in a cookbook smoking a cigarette. He's gaunt and scraggly and dirty. And stress like we are. It's finally a chef who looks like us. There's hope. I mean, I wanted to connect. I wanted the reader, who I envisioned as a cook, to feel that same sense of connection as I felt when I saw the pictures in White Heat. But it was a book it was a book written without guile. I was fucking clueless. I mean, I didn't have time. I didn't have the luxury. I woke up at 5:30 in the morning and would light a cigarette before I brushed my teeth even, and I'd write for a couple hours, and then I'd look at the clock and realize I had to be in, and I'd go.
Yeah.
I didn't have time. It was a book written very quickly. I was thinking about Down and Out in London and Paris.
Yeah.
And how that book made me feel when I read it. Down and Out in Paris and London.
Yeah.
And White Heat, how that made me feel when I saw it as a cook.
Yeah.
That's all I was looking for, that response from cooks.
Yeah.
That was as far as it went with me when I wrote the book.
Yeah, cooking's really hard work, professional cooking. Obviously, at some age, it starts to become taxing physically. But do you miss being on the line? Do you miss being in a kitchen?
I miss the camaraderie, of course. I miss the lack of bullshit, because you can't bullshit in the kitchen. You know, you can't talk about yourself. You can't inflate yourself, because everyone will know tomorrow.
Right.
I like living in a pure meritocracy.
Yeah.
I like that first cold beer after work. I like hanging with cooks and people who work for a living.
Yeah.
Who prove their mettle. Men and women who prove their mettle every day, every hour.
Yeah.
If they say they're going to do a thing.
Yeah.
They're quickly no longer in your orbit.
Right.
But I had 28 years of it.
Yeah.
I don't delude myself into thinking that I'd be useful. I'd be a liability.
Yeah.
I was in decline already at 44. I mean, Kitchen Confidential was very good timing for me, as it turned out.
Right.
Cooking is fucking hard. People just... They pretend to acknowledge, people who don't do it for a living pretend to acknowledge it.
Yeah.
But they don't know how hard it actually is. because we're not talking about a hard thing. We're talking about a hard thing every day the same, and that is difficult indeed.
The monotony of the actual work.
No, it's just the pressure of doing the same job just as fast and just as well.
Yeah.
The same standards and identically looking and tasting identical.
Yeah.
Again and again and again with no variance.
Yeah.
That's hard.
There was this line, I forget if it's in the introduction or very, it must be in the foreword of the introduction. In Kitchen Confidential, there's some line, you were transitioning or into a time, I guess, of being both a chef and a writer. And there was a line you had, if my car breaks down at 3 o'clock in the morning in a bad neighborhood, I'm calling a chef, I'm calling a cook, I'm not calling a writer.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you just said, I assume is kind of the long version of what you meant by that?
Yeah, I mean, if you're in a lifeboat, I mean, who do you want to be stuck on a desert island with, a cook or a writer?
Totally different question.
Yeah.
What's the most surprising place that you've ever been recognized
with? The show's seen everywhere now. So, Borneo. The question is actually, look, there's always going to be, if nothing else, there'll always be somebody from another country, whether they're, you know, whether it's a Singapore, I could be in rural China, but a Singaporean or Malaysian tourist will recognize me. No, it's more, you know, where were their, like, crazy fans? Like, Paraguay, I was like.
Crazy, you know, fans defined how?
Like, enthusiastic fans are sitting in a lobby at my, who somehow found out what hotel I'm staying at, or sitting
there like,
for 6 hours
out,
waiting for me to wake up, you know?
And wanted what from you? A picture? An autograph?
Picture,
to hang out?
Picture. Just a picture.
Just a picture. Does that blow your mind?
It's weird. I mean, it's strange. It feels odd. It's not. It's a jarring difference between the way I used to live and the way I live now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel puffed up by it or freaked out by it or annoyed by it. I mean, unless I'm running for, you know, I'm running for the bathroom in between flights. It's a little annoying, but
right.
Look, it's easier than filling up the steam table at a shitty restaurant you don't like.
Right.
In the morning, knowing you're about to cook food that you hate for people you hate.
Right.
Brunch is hard. You know? Posing for selfies in Paraguay in a lobby.
Right.
Not so hard.
You know, I was watching that episode the other night, and the way you were talking about Bocuse really struck me. I mean, you were clearly very humbled to be...
Well, struggling to not
meet. In his presence.
Yeah. Look, I don't stress enough, I never in my life ever thought, for most of my life, I never thought ever would I eat at Bocuse, much less sit with him, much less hang out, go hunting, hang in his lodge with him and his mistress, you know?
Yeah.
Day one, I met his wife. Day two, I'm with hanging out with him and his mistress.
Yeah.
I never, I mean, I'm a, I am utterly, I mean, you can see, I was like I had the vapors.
Yeah.
I was like it was total in the presence of a lifelong hero of mine. Very, very aware of it. Very nervous and excited and emotional and grateful and you know, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it. Still can't believe it. I look back on it, I can't believe it.
Who else would be in a similar territory for you? Whether it's a chef or a writer or, I mean, who would be hard for you to kind of be cool around?
Oh, Keith Richards.
Have you met him?
No. Keith Richards, for sure. Bill Murray was on the show.
Yeah.
But it's like it happened in a fugue state, you know, like still.
Right.
My voice gets all high and squeaky and weird.
Yeah.
Iggy.
That show you just mentioned, hanging out with Bocuse and his, you know, those farmers and the guys he was hanging out with, which was kind of it was a place for him to be where kind of his celebrity became.
Yeah, they don't call him Monsieur Paul.
Right.
You know, he's the neighbor.
Do you have a group like that? I mean, you don't
no.
have to name names. You don't have, like...
Well, this is the reason why hanging out with chefs and cooks is more comfortable than hanging out with writers. There's no sense of anything outside of the moment. I mean, I'm... I feel very comfortable hanging out with even chefs who I don't see often.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Eric is, you know, my closest friend. You know, I probably see him more often than any other friend.
Right.
In fact, I'm sure I do.
Yeah.
Jose.
Yeah.
But I travel 250 days a year.
Yeah.
You know, there are chef friends who I only see every couple of years.
Yeah.
But I'm always moving.
Yeah.
By conventional standards, I'm a bad friend. You know, I'm not there. I'm not there to remember your birthday.
Right.
Or to offer you words of support that I'm unaware of through Twitter.
Right.
I'm not up on what you're doing in New York because I'm not in New York.
Right.
I'm not, what would they call it in parenting circles, present.
Yeah.
You know, which is, you know, I guess it's a coincidence that, you know, I get along so well with Eric and Jose. We're both sort of, you know, half in, half out of the public eye.
Yeah.
Traveling a lot.
Sure.
And so it's like I'm not offended if I call Jose and he doesn't call me back for a few days, or Eric, because I understand. I get it. You know, this is the way we live now. But, you know, if I want to get together for drinks with my closest friends, you know, my assistant calls their assistant because that's the most efficient way to do it.
Sure.
And most respectful way as well.
Sure.
It's a very weird, freakish situation a lot of us find ourselves in. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
But no, I don't have a country place.
I don't have a group that gets together every whatever. I don't have an organized anything.
I don't have bowling buddies or anything resembling that.
Right.
A regular card game or a regular anything, because I wouldn't be there for most of those regular. There's no regularity to my schedule.
Yeah.
In any regularity to my schedule, you know, my first fucking priority is always going to be, you know, I'm spending that time with my daughter.
I'm just wondering if you've been hearing this. It's something I hear a lot, and I just wanted your comment on it. I am amazed at how often, lately when I've been talking to cooks and or chefs, but even young chefs, even guys who are just in their 30s, you know, like I'm doing a book with the guys from Battersby in Brooklyn, and, you know, even they, and they're, you know, covered in tattoos and on their phone all the time. They look, for all the world, like very casual young cooks.
Right.
They have to be very serious about what they do. But New York, L.A., San Francisco, I've heard this time and time again, that there seems to be less of an observance of, let's call it sort of a, you know, an honor code among, in the kitchen, like the way people leave jobs, the way people don't show up all of a sudden, have you heard this from people?
It seems I hear chefs complaining about it.
Like people quitting by text an hour before their shift.
Yeah.
And they say this would never happen in the old days, but then you'll hear a 30-year-old tell you the same thing.
It happened in the old days too.
Yeah. You think it's just become a little easier because of the technology?
Are the kids today, you know, these kids today? I don't know. To me, the amount of goofs, there have always been a certain proportion of people who think they're going to be great in the restaurant business and think they're going to do great in the kitchen, but end up washing out.
Yeah.
I think that number stays pretty constant throughout, like, the last few centuries.
Yeah.
I think there's a hardcore kernel of people, definite minority, who at the end of the day were designed or shaped or just are right.
Yeah.
You know, to find a home in the restaurant business.
Right.
Others, for one reason or another, will either wash out quickly or wash out over time or be found out.
Yeah.
To be just not have it.
Yeah.
Are there more of them now? I think maybe it's the same assholes, they're just different assholes. They come in talking a lot of shit about how they want to end up with a TV show. Instead of, you know, maybe 30 years ago, they would have come in saying some other shit.
Right.
Their aspirations may be different.
Right.
But they're the same goofs, and they fail for the same reason.
Yeah.
Which is generally the inability to show up on time and do what you said you were going to do yesterday.
Sure. Right.
It's a character issue.
Thank you. You know? So how it's manifested doesn't really...
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Can I ask you about a couple of third rail topics?
Yeah.
It's Beard Awards season.
Yeah.
You went off on the Beard Awards a couple of years ago. Called it a goat rodeo.
Yeah.
Said it doesn't recognize the... minority population, and I think you said it was the backbone, heart, and lungs of the industry.
Mexicans don't exist to them, except as a theme for their multicultural, you know, whatever it was a few years ago. They played mariachi music over there, as usual. Look, here's why the Beard Awards are good. Because chefs truly deserve, chefs who work hard all year, who give their heart, their blood, their soul, their sweat, their job. You should be able to dress up in tuxedos once a year and get a statue and then go out and have a big party.
All in the same city.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's nice that their crews, the people who work for these chefs, if their chef wins a Beard Award, that they can go home feeling like, wow, all of our work meant something. Look, we won a Beard Award.
Right.
That's about it. It is a fundamentally bullshit organization. The most outrageous example being, look, James Beard was, I mean, look, it's a perfect choice. An unpleasant, entitled snob. Why do you need a James Beard house? A shrine. This is it's a perfect example. They're in the business of perpetuating their own importance and keeping themselves on salary and at the center of any discussion about food. In every other way outside of those awards, they are fucking useless. Go to the James Beard house. It is a non-functioning kitchen, a non-functioning dining area, a space.
Yeah.
Attended by nobodies, people with zero influence in food, zero awareness of what's going on in food.
Yeah.
It is a private dining society of fucking golfers.
Yeah.
It is a predatory organization, my way of thinking. Because they call up, you're the best restaurant in Cincinnati. You're just starting to get up on your feet, right?
Yeah.
You're not out of the red yet. James Beard Awards call up, we'd really like you to do a dinner at the James Beard House. We're not paying for the food.
Right.
We're not paying for the staff. We're not paying a peak to staff or your restaurant while you and your whole staff are gone. We're not even providing you a suitable place to cook the fucking food.
Right.
We're giving you the honor of giving us a bunch of your sweat off your brow, a bunch of free fucking labor, food, air travel, lodging, all the rest to cook for a bunch of nobodies who will help you in no way under the implied promise that if you do this for us, you got a shot at getting the award. It's not explicitly stated. It's not necessarily implied, but that's what everybody's afraid of.
Right.
Okay? Never forget my friends from Australia, took that long flight going upstairs to finally see who was in the dining room. What this had all been about. $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 cost them to do this thing.
Yeah.
Hey, chef, how come you didn't serve any koala, the award ceremony, make sure to hold it in one place in New York that has zero cooking facilities. The tasting, they're getting free food and work off people in return for nothing.
Right.
For nothing. What? Honoring people who deserve to be honored? Recognizing people who deserve to be honored? How about like a reading? What they give you? Look at their books that I do every year. It's a pretty lamentable spread of money. They take in a whole lot of money, and very little goes out or back to anything useful. This business they claim to love, look, at least a fund for, instead of creating new awards to throw more dinners, how about a fucking fund or a fundraiser to provide paralegals for this huge plurality of Central American and Mexican workers who make up this business they claim to love and honor. How about that? How about coming out publicly and spending some money advocating for modification of our immigration laws. No. These are hideous. You know, it's everything that's wrong with dining. They're, you know, entitled, otherwise unemployable people. They're golfers.
Are there any awards out there or honors that you think are, that you admire, that you think are in the, you know, in the industry?
There should be.
But you don't
professional. No. I mean, like, the short answer is no.
Yeah.
But I mean, if chefs voted, like Producers Guild or something like that, if professionals voted, truly voted for professionals only in those categories that they were knowledgeable of, meaning, okay, I haven't been in Seattle, but I know who the big dog is. Ooh, I recognize his name, I'll vote for him.
Right.
Meaning, if people from specific areas voted for within only industry people,
mm-hmm.
Now, that would be nice. But, you know, look, we're not, chefs are not not the sort of people that get organized.
Right.
They're anti-organization. Look, I totally get, I'm so happy for when I hear friends of mine get the beer award because I know they're happy.
Right.
It's a good party and their kitchen staffs appreciate it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's realistic to hope for a better, for an alternative, because whoever it is,
mm-hmm.
who starts it up, again, it's going to be more of the same. You know, there's certain people who call up and ask chefs for things.
Right.
It's something of an industry. People who call up, you know, chefs are already so generous, so involved in, generally speaking, the first people you want to call for, you know, a charity or a food bank. But on top of that, it's all of, you know, taste of Chelsea you know, the magazines are fucking brutal. Every magazine has its own little festival, you know? Let's put it this way. If a trash hauling outfit, if a recycling outfit from Staten Island did half the shit that these people calling chefs do regularly, you know, it would be an indictable offense. I'm in a gourmet institute. You know, come on.
Right.
What the fuck is that?
This topic that's been out, I mean, it's been out, I don't know, I feel like it's been out there again a little bit recently, or to me it's just kind of the current world order. But this idea of how important, did you see the Times magazine a couple weeks back, the food and drink issue?
Which article?
It had, well, the Bittman piece about chefs, you know, being out of the kitchen.
Was he for or against?
Well, he was kind of, half of it was just a memory piece about what it used to be like to go eat John George's
food. Was it his memories or was someone else working for him? I never read Bittman because I'm not even sure it's him.
He was talking about the, you know, something basically the 80s, you know, early 90s when everyone had one restaurant and they were there, and whether or not something's been lost in that not being the case.
It's a bullshit issue raised by bored, you know, paid by the word writers who need to file a couple of thousand words on absolute bullshit. Because every single one of them fucking knows that the entire chef business revolves around the guiding principle that the chef should be able to have Sunday off with their food exactly the same as every other day of the week. They understand. It is a completely disingenuous discussion.
Right.
Okay? Some people can take Sunday off without a diminution of quality.
Yeah.
Others can't. Some chefs can open many restaurants without a diminution of quality. Others clearly can't. There's nothing new about that. There's nothing worth fucking discussing. This whole notion that Jean-Georges should pop up smiling at my elbow every time I go in is bullshit. Whether I'm Mark Bittman or anybody else. I'm pissed about it. I don't even know what we're fucking talking about.
But you've heard of this topic, Chris.
Yes. And it's stupid.
It's well, my favorite line was
it's pretending that we don't know what we know, which is Jean-Georges hasn't touched a fucking salad in 30 years, and we shouldn't expect him to. He's great, and we know his name for reasons other than his magical way with the salad.
Right. There was a, you know, there's this great Alain Sayac line that he used into the dining room of Le Cirque, and customers would say, "Who's cooking my food while you're out here?"
Right.
And he said, "The same people that cook it when I'm in the kitchen."
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, it just, what is Mario's particular genius? Okay? Mario's particular genius is not cooking pasta.
Right.
It's been a fuck of a long time since Mario Batali cooked anybody's pasta. Mario Batali's particular genius is having spectacular good taste in, he's a spectacularly good judge of character and ability.
Mm-hmm.
He chooses very interesting partners, creative partners, who offer something to him and to the world. That's one of the things he's very, very good at. I go to a Mario Batali restaurant, the last thing in the world I want or expect is Mario to be cooking my pasta. Anybody who suggests that it's not as good as when he was cooking your pasta have already proven themselves to be, you know, idiots. It's an unforgivable offense in food writing, as far as I'm concerned. Even be having the discussion. It's stupid beyond words. Chef means chief.
Right.
Leader. By the time you got to know these chefs' names, they had been cooking themselves in quite some time.
Right.
That's why you know their names.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're good leaders.
When we're talking about these issues, and you're just giving me your straight opinion, mm-hmm. is that anything that's hard for you? I assume it's not hard for you to do.
What, giving you my straight opinion?
It's very hard as someone, I mean, I interview a lot of people. It's very hard to get just a straight, honest opinion.
Well, are people going to say, oh, he's mean? You know,
right.
Or he's full of shit, or he doesn't know what he's talking about? I don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes all of those things are true.
This episode is presented by the Brooklyn Kitchen, a recreational cooking school on a mission to change the world by teaching people how to cook like grown-ups. The Brooklyn Kitchen began in 2006 when two creative home chefs, Taylor Erkinen and Harry Rosenblum, recognized an opportunity to create a community space with approachable, hands-on cooking classes and inventive culinary experiences. Taylor and Harry believe that cooking is a daily practice in creative problem-solving. They bring this ethos to the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking school that fosters community and redefines home cooking for everyone. Now located at Sunset Park's Industry City, the Brooklyn Kitchen hosts a range of public and private cooking classes, corporate team parties, pop-up dinners, and tasting events for cooks of all levels. Learn more at thebrooklynkitchen.com.
Hey, are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Kathy Irway, and I'm the host of Eat Your Words here on HRN. Every week I sit down with food writers to talk about their newest work, from colorful cookbooks to food memoirs to exposés on the food industry. It's all meaty topic for discussion. You can find Eat Your Words wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. We are going to return you now to the rest of the interview with Anthony Bourdain without delay. We're not going to go on and on and on about it. You know what's funny about the intro to the show, though, Julia? Right before we started, I said, can we both please be mindful that people just want to hear the interview? And let's not go into a Tony Bourdain rabbit hole. And then we talked for almost half an hour.
Uh-oh.
But you know what? I think it's worth it. I think this is a week for reflection and sharing. Where we are a year on from the loss. Just quickly, some people come up in this part two of the interview. Patrick Clark was a chef in New York City, died tragically young of... I always thought he had died, I think it was reported as congestive heart failure at the time. I met a relative of his at the Petard anniversary party the other day. I think she's his cousin. And it turns out that is actually what was cause of death, but there was an underlying condition, which I never knew. In any event, if you don't know that name, he was the original chef of Odeon. He was one of the few, what we would call celebrity chefs, who was African-American back in these days.
One of the very, very,
very few. But he was a huge person in New York City. He was at the Odeon. He was briefly at Tavern on the Green. Nobody lasts Oops. There very long. He had a place called Metro on the Upper West Side. He was Odeon was the first Keith McNally project, right. which he did with his brother Brian and Lynn. Can you pronounce her last name? Wagon. I don't want to mispronounce her last name, Lynn. But Lynn was
Lynn
Keith McNally's now ex-wife.
Yeah.
But anyway, they also did Cafe Luxembourg, and that Patrick was the chef there for a while. So he comes up at one point. That's who he is.
Right.
Anne Rosenzweig came up. She is a famously reclusive, still lives in New York, used to have a restaurant called Arcadia, had a restaurant called The Lobster Club. There was just an article about her recently, a pretty big profile. I forget where it ran. But she famously doesn't give many interviews. I actually could not get an interview with her for my book. I tried through multiple intermediaries. No response. That's fine. She doesn't owe me an interview. But that's who Anne Rosenzweig is, for people who won't know that name, which actually is probably a lot of you listeners. But she was huge in New York City in the 80s.
What were the years that she would have been huge?
I mean, huge was, I can't say exactly, but mid-80s to early 90s. You know, she was actually at 21 at one point at the 21 Club, a right. woman chef at one yeah. of the most like macho, moneyed restaurants in New York. Anne was a big deal.
Right.
And then once again, a name that comes up a lot, Jean-Louis Peladan.
Right. I remember him.
If you don't know who that is, you need, just go look him up. It's too much yeah. for me to say, but I will say this is maybe the fourth interview where somebody has spoken in absolutely reverential
yeah,
terms.
I remember that guy.
But he was the chef at Jean-Louis at the Watergate, briefly at a place called yeah. the Time Hotel yeah. in New York, died of lung cancer. He was a human chimney with the smoking, but just a larger-than-life figure who Tony talks about here. Anyway, I just wanted to mention those things to orient you all. And also, I want to say when we get to the end, you mentioned earlier, Julia, this was a print interview. This is really the difference between podcasting, which yeah. even this conversation is in some way a performance, or you're trying to speak in a way that makes it
yeah.
listenable. You're trying to be emphatic and yep. project. This interview ends so abruptly, which I don't mean that he ran off. We actually ended up sitting and gossiping for an hour.
Right.
But what I meant was, it just, I got what I needed. I asked my yeah. last question, and then it just kind of ends. I mean, it's
okay,
very,
we're done, click.
Yeah, yeah, he's like, cool, and then it ends. So just to prepare everybody for that, that's it. I think that's it. All right, guys. With that, here you go. Part two of my interview with Anthony Bourdain from April 2014. I hope you enjoy the rest of it.
We just had this talk about kind of what I'm writing about, this time I'm writing, people starting to cook. When I just say all that to you, what personally, what just comes to mind for you about your own sort of beginnings of your own interest, your interest in food?
I like to say I fell into the business for all the wrong reasons. I fell in because I was rootless. I didn't believe in anything. I didn't really have any solid aspirations or ambitions that I actually believed in or had any convictions in. I was disillusioned. There was no club I wanted to be a member of. I was pressed into a dishwashing job, and I saw for the first time in my life a group of people whose respect I wanted. And at the end of a good shift, a busy shift, if I'd done a good job, I respected myself. I went home for the first time in my life respecting myself and craving the respect of other people. That was a first for me. So it began with that, long before the food itself became a factor. That while it may have, while my early childhood experiences and my upbringing, which was relatively, food did play a part, I guess a larger part than that, than it did with most of my peers of the 60s, that resonated later.
Yeah.
But I came to that point a little down the road. I yeah. wanted to be part of that group. I wanted to be part of that society. I wanted to be acknowledged and respected within that community.
You first go into a kitchen at age?
17.
And at that time, if you were going to describe it, what the profession was thought of like?
I mean, degraded. I mean, we were... we were not even the backstairs help. We were people, you don't mind looking at the backstairs help. We were the last people in the world anyone wanted to see or acknowledge.
Yeah.
We were, the people I worked with were really marginal. I mean, they worked as chefs and cooks when they could, and when they couldn't, they do other work. It,
right.
It was all the same to them.
Yeah.
Roofing, house painting, shucking scallops at the scallop plant. Didn't matter. There was nobody there for quite some time. There was nobody there who was passionate about food.
Yeah.
And it was very much an environment, as I quickly found out, whereas if you were passionate about food, you would be spanked for it. I mean, for many years after that point, and until maybe the 90s, if you were generally punished for your best efforts, if you learned about food and you learned about the history of the things that you loved and how they were prepared best, and how the masters did it, in this country you were punished for that year in, year out. I mean, we just saw Chef together.
Yeah.
And look, you know, it's a sort of a romantic comedy, but, and we're a little bit past that point as far as beef cheeks, and, you know, you can sell beef cheeks now, and you can sell kidneys, but, I mean, try to serve a properly cooked piece of fish in 1978 or 80, you were going to get fucking spanked for it 50% out of the time. Serve fish on the bone. You know, you're mad. You make people upset. You were the last person in the world that the customer wanted to see. And if they did see you, they wanted you to go, you know, pop. Oh, yes, what would Monsieur Madame like?
Right.
And then they told you.
Yeah.
They don't want to know what you know.
Yeah.
They could care less. The shortcut to heartbreak was to actually to care about your food and invest your own personal history, your own likes and dislikes, your own experience and training, to invest that in the food that you were selling to customers.
Yeah.
It was a shortcut to heartbreak.
Yeah. When you start becoming aware, you know, we talked about this episode of your show when we sat down. When did you start becoming aware of Bocuse and start reading books? I assume you probably read The Great Chefs of France, the book that everyone talks about.
Look, as a pretentious little shit, you know, having recently come off the deep fryer and having been to France a few times and looking at Culinary Institute as an option, you know, these are the sort of books I bought and gaped at.
Mm-hmm.
So we all know who Bocuse was. He was, did we know his, you know, I didn't, it's a lazy and easy thing for me to say I knew of Bocuse. Others of my age were doing everything they could to actually work for him or someone like him. You know, those are the untouchable ideals.
Right.
It was unthinkable that any of us would ever work for him. I mean, back in 80. I mean, there were people. You know, when I was working in like 1980, 82 in Soho, I talk about how primitive the food was and what we were doing and how we thought we were hot shit. But the fact is, right under our noses, not far away, you know, Chanterelle was open.
Mm-hmm.
Look how far ahead they were. There were people who went to Europe and staged.
Yeah.
I just didn't know. So in a lot of ways, you're asking the wrong guy.
So you weren't really aware of, we wear the quilted?
I was aware of it, but look, by the time I was really fully cognizant of my business, it was already too late. I'd already thrown my lot in with the party boys. You know, I could have and should have been aware of Quilted Giraffe or Chanterelle. I could have and should have been knocking on their door. I didn't. I was too comfortable with my crew of knuckleheads, my own sort of network of people with priorities like mine. We thought we were geniuses. We thought we knew how to cook. We thought we had something to say, and that it would not in any way interfere with our rigorous schedule of getting fucked up and staying out all night. It just didn't occur to me.
It's amazing to me to hear someone say that, that you could be cooking in Soho in New York and not have a greater...
It is a measure, of both our just how far we were up our own asses, how insular... I mean, you know, we didn't get... You know, remember, cooks and chefs back then, you couldn't afford to eat a chanterelle.
Sure.
Well, that's outrageous to even think about it.
Yeah.
I didn't have a jacket.
Yeah.
But no, we were... There were those who did know and did seek those things out. Unfortunately, I just wasn't one of them.
So did you...
It was not my world. It was not my milieu.
So did you not... So you didn't know... So there are these young guys at this time. You're talking early 80s. These guys were working on the Kobas.
And women. Anne Rosenzweig. Sure.
Leslie Revson.
For instance. Leslie Revson. I mean, these people were out there kicking ass and making names early.
Yeah.
You know, I slowly and dimly became aware of them, I guess. Largely because it was noticeable that, like, there were chefs whose names would appear in the paper and were known. Mm-hmm. That was sort of a surprise.
What was the socially at that time? You work in a restaurant. You mostly hang with the people from your restaurant.
I didn't know anyone I didn't know anyone who wasn't a cook or a restaurant employee.
But I mean, there wasn't my understanding from other people, and I'd just love to know what your take is. You know, I'd say, because, you know, years later, 10 years after what we're talking about right now, and a little earlier than that was the thing that Palmer and the Chef's Cuisiniers, and then Blue Ribbon happens.
Right.
And there become these, like, hubs. You ask people from the early 80s, who'd you hang with? And there didn't seem to be a lot of cross-pollination.
I wasn't in that league. Secondly, look, I'd go to work, I'd hang with my crew, you know, we'd work together, then we'd go out, maybe meet up with other cooks like us, musicians, because we had the same hours.
Yeah.
It was drugs and alcohol. Drugs, alcohol, and, you know, I only slept with people within the industry. I only hung out with people within the industry. I had no clue, really, until, you know, I wrote a novel, Bobby Gold Stories, which is very much sort of a reflection of, it's about a bouncer who's starting to wonder what it would be like if he, what the white picket fence world would be like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at age, I guess by age 38, 40, I was starting to wonder what kind of lives my customers went home to. Up until that point, I never wondered about these things. I didn't know anything about, I knew that if there were 100 customers that 40 of them would go for the salmon. Given a choice between salmon and chicken, 40 would go for the salmon, 60 for the chicken.
Mm-hmm.
I knew their eating and drinking habits pretty well.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about what their lives might be like. I was aware of my own childhood. I knew that people had backyards, that they grilled in those backyards if they had one. Parenting, weekends, going out to dinner with people who weren't other cooks.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any understanding of any of those things.
Or
I had
interest?
I not only had no sympathy, I had actual contempt. I think you see that in Kitchen Confidential. My contempt for Emeril, who of course I didn't know, my contempt for the customers, because I didn't know them at all. I couldn't imagine what their lives were like, other than that they were an annoyance to me, in a way. As I reached near the end of my 30s, I was starting to wonder what must it be like to have a yard, to have health insurance, to own a car, to drive places, to buy furniture, to have a child. my God, what this? To go to the beach with a child and walk into the waves.
Right.
To look into a child's face for whom you're the sun and the moon. All of these were completely alien feelings.
Do you think that was common to people you were friends with and worked with?
I don't know. Look, I'm of another time. And I'm well known for things other than my cooking. Mm-hmm. So all of my friends who I talk about these things with were much more successful and are much more successful chefs. And in order to be that, I think guys like Mario and Jose and Eric, they grew up, I mean, they figured out a way to make lives for themselves within the industry way earlier than me. I didn't really, you know, grow up, leave my post-adolescence even, until I was middle-aged. I mean, I was... for me, the restaurant industry allowed me to stay a child for most of my life.
Yeah. Did you...
I mean, as long as I could cook well, or well enough, and do the job, as long as I could... Look, as long as you can cook 300 orders of Eggs Benedict between 12 o'clock and 4 o'clock, you know what? There's going to be work for you in this business.
But how do you reconcile what you're saying with this, like, reverence for somebody like, you know, Paul Bocuse and these other...
We were actually stupid enough and high enough and full of ourselves enough to think that we would someday. We just didn't understand the cost of being Paul Bocuse. We didn't understand. We didn't know that he started with La Mer Brasier. That he, you know, where he came from or what, or the hours he put in. We didn't know those things.
Yeah.
We thought that we would somehow find ourselves, if not him, at least able to get away with something like that. I mean, we were clueless.
When people started to get famous in this around this time...
That's me. I want to be very clear. When I'm talking about I'm talking about me and my friends. I'm not talking about people of my generation, because there were smart people out there who fucking understood you had to put in your time.
Yeah.
I didn't understand.
When you... first of all, I should back up. When you decide you want to do this for a living, what was your family's reaction back then?
Look, they weren't thrilled, but I think at that point, I don't know that they were disappointed. I was a problem kid. I seemingly had no particular ambition to do anything. I hated everything. The fact that I had a job and seemed excited about something, and that there was some order, some structure, discipline in my life probably came as something of a relief.
When a lot of people I've spoken to, not just for the book, but in other interviews, it comes up all the time. There seems to be, and I don't want to, not for everyone, but it seems to be a majority of people in cooking that I've spoken to, they're almost metabolically incompatible with formal education, with sitting still in a classroom, with testing, with some aspect of it, for various reasons.
First of all, traditionally, you know, in France, you'll find, particularly when you talk to chefs with brothers, the smarter brother gets sent to university. The less smart one, the slower one, gets sent off to Uncle Henri to learn the family business. They can't, you know, someone's got to make money around here.
Right.
You know, we're spending all of our money on the smart one. You're going to start earning a living. We can't carry you. So there's a long tradition of, like, something less than the best and the brightest ending up in the business.
Yeah.
But it's more than that. It's the... I know a lot of chefs who are dyslexic.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot of chefs who tell me, because I heard this from people who read Kitchen Confidential, that they hadn't read another book since high school.
Right.
I think a lot of people who are uncomfortable in their verbal comprehension skills, reading comprehension, who felt awkward speaking, who struggled with language. Here's a business that's nonverbal, that's sensual, that you can express yourself without using language. Reading skills not needed,
right?
Really. You can get around it. Also, I think there are a lot of people who just sense to themselves a general discomfort with polite society. I mean, working in an office, interacting with others in a larger situation, interacting with a room full of equals, awkward, difficult. You don't get the high school, you don't get the quarterback, the high school quarterback in a kitchen that much. You're people who are adrift, at odds, who feel, shy people. Some of your biggest shouters are very shy, actually very shy, insecure, tenuous people outside of the kitchen.
Right.
So I think it's that.
But a lot of these people also, I'm sure you'd agree with this, they're highly intelligent people.
Oh, yeah.
They're street smart. Like, it's,
super street smart.
A lot of them become very good business people.
Often get very good at spoken word, at telling stories, but in a patois.
Yeah.
Not in a way that they would feel comfortable writing a school paper in.
Right.
I mean, a lot of the most absolutely devastating. I mean, Gordon Ramsay can be pretty fucking poetic, especially back in the day.
Yeah.
Or a better example, Mark Up Your Wife.
Sure.
But I mean, he's dyslexic. He struggles with really struggles with writing a paragraph. Yes. Would be very, very difficult. I'm sorry, your question again was?
I was saying, it was I guess, a follow-up.
They're smart.
They have these issues, but they're actually very highly intelligent.
And able to multitask.
Yeah.
Look, in order to be a chef, which again means chief or leader, you have to be able to multitask. You have to handle pressure. And you have to be able to look a wide variety of people in the eye and really put yourself right into them in a heart and soul. You have to understand, you have to communicate, you have to somehow motivate people to do a very difficult thing every day.
Yeah.
That is, you're managing people. I think most chefs would be very good CIA case officers, for instance. Some would be good military leaders, others would be probably better to be a CIA case officer, trying to convince somebody to, do something they never would have thought of doing.
Yes.
And do it every day and stay motivated.
Right. You just mentioned Mark Up Your Wife a minute ago. When I first saw this project, you tweeted me and said, "Are you going to do Mark Up Your Wife?" And I wrote back and said, "My book's focused on the U.S. And you said, we all want it to be him. What did you mean by that? Because he has not come up that much with guys, strangely.
Well, it's of a certain generation, but I mean, he's a hero. I'm surprised to hear that. It's really funny. Most chefs I know start talking about Marco, they get all like, no. He was never a role model to me. Oh, his cooking, this, that, the other thing. But young cooks, anybody see? Now, some chefs actually get really pissy about it. Really pissy. Just refuse to accept Marco's importance. I just want to deny it.
But what was it for you?
He looked like chefs I knew. He looked like us. He was the first chef who wasn't a fat French guy, a well-fed French guy. He was an English guy with long, scraggly hair, rings under his eyes, gaunt cheeks, who smoked. And smoked in his fucking cookbook. And then you turn the page and there was this incredible, gorgeous food.
Right.
That made an impression. Wow, that guy is capable of that. What does that mean for me? Does that might mean that I'm capable of something.
Right.
Plus, he just looks so fucking cool.
Yeah.
And, he's a very handsome. You can go on about the rock and roll good looks, but the fact is, he was the first rock and roll chef.
Yeah.
And we've been all listening to rock and roll. It had been a rock and roll profession for a long time without ever any public expression of that ethic. I mean, that was our secret, that we listened to rock and roll in the kitchen was our thing. No one knew that.
The whole gimmick, meaning
we literally all liked rock and roll and listened to rock and roll in the kitchen and essentially lived like we were Motley Crue when we weren't working and sometimes when we were working.
Right.
Which is why a lot of us were in the business. You could get fucked and drunk and treated like you were a rock and roll star without being famous or even playing guitar. But the point is, what we were doing in the kitchen was not the image that we projected. The dining room was supposed to think that we were all listening to classical music in there,
right,
and that we were all French guys.
Right.
Here was the first acknowledgement that what's happening in a kitchen is what we know it to be, rather
right.
than what we assume everybody wants it to be, which is
right.
what we're all pretending, you know? And we don't pretend. You see chefs transform. They walk out, cornstarch in the balls, out through the kitchen doors. You know, suddenly it's the continental accent. It's like those old school maitre d's, you know. You ask them, what country, they speak French, they speak Italian perfectly, and they'll be either of those things depending on what restaurant they're working at. And you ask them, where are you from, Dimitri? I am from Europe. We had no template. We had no role model. We had nobody other than these French dudes.
Yeah.
And here was a guy who, clearly... Wow,
Yeah.
And look, he's right in the cookbook.
Yeah.
There's his food. There's him.
Yeah. When you, do you have any insight, what's your own thought or thoughts about why so many young Americans start gravitating toward this profession? In the mid-late 70s?
Did they? Nah, that wasn't that early.
Relatively speaking.
Not a clue. Why? I don't know. I mean, I know why they're doing it now.
Oh, sure.
But in the 70s? Well, maybe, I just have to guess. People who were disenchanted with, we learned what to become disenchanted with in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
which was everything. And all the shit that was supposed to offer us hope in the 70s wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing. It was all bullshit. It offered a rock and roll lifestyle where you go home feeling proud of yourself because you worked.
Mm-hmm.
You did, at the end of the day, you did honest fucking work.
Right.
With your back and your hands and all of your senses. And there was a creative aspect to it.
Yeah.
You got to build a house. You got to make it yours a little bit.
Right.
And you got to do all of these things that... that we thought everybody wants to do.
Right. When do people start coming on... you mentioned before you weren't aware of Fontrelle or not really focused. When do you start focusing on places like that?
On where?
On restaurants that mattered at the time.
Late. Really late. For me, pathetically late.
Like post-92?
Sometime in the late 80s, I started really looking around at that first wave of, Waxman and Rosenzweig, Patrick Clark.
Who really stood out for you? Like, who resonated
Paladin.
With you at the time?
Paladin.
Amazing. Why?
I found myself for some completely bullshit reason, I found myself at the D'Artagnan 10th year anniversary party.
Yeah.
After which I got swept up in a big crew. I was fucking nobody. I was the chef of the supper club at the time.
This was in D.C.?
No, in New York.
Oh, in New York.
And I got swept up with a bunch of other chefs. We all went to Brasserie in the middle of the night. And I found myself sitting next to Paladin. And he talked to me the whole night. Why me? I don't know. That's a measure of what I've since learned is very much was in his character. I remember his hands, how incredibly rough they were. I mean, this is a guy who fucking worked his whole life. And how passionate he was about food. What an interesting, how just so different a creature he was than the people I'd known in the business.
What do you remember from that interaction?
That I was in the presence of a genius.
You could tell just sitting there. How so?
His posture, the way he talked, the passion, and just his knowledge was terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, I want to talk about species of mushrooms. I mean, can whatever.
We talk about stuff like this at that
dinner? Everything.
You know, I interviewed Keller for the book, and I asked him if how much of an influence Trotter had been on his ambitions. You know, the kind of European style restaurant, the tasty menu, and he said, you know, Andrew, if you look backwards, I could see why that would make sense. He said, but for me, it was Jean-Louis.
Yeah, I think it's for
he said, just the sheer ambition of it.
The most look, just the supply chain. I mean, all of these companies that wouldn't exist without him.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy would like party all night and then go driving all over the Northeast looking for sources for food. He single-handedly, you know, created the environment and inspired and changed every chef he ever worked with.
Right.
But I think, you know, there were a number of chefs who, by virtue of their confidence and alone, the way they presented themselves, who I brushed up against, really impressed me. Patrick Clark was one.
What do you remember about him? You ate at Odeon?
Yeah, and worked with him, auditioned for a gig at one of his restaurants, which I didn't get.
What, Metro?
And, no, the Upper West Side, Luxembourg. He was in Luxembourg.
Yeah.
And he worked at Supper Club one night for a special event. He was convinced of his own self-importance, of his own importance. He was convinced that he was really, really good, and he sold that, and that impressed me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, I didn't know a lot of people who were that certain of their place in the world.
Yeah.
This guy was confident in his ability and his... the treatment that he deserved in return.
Did you experience Jonathan that way?
No, I didn't get to know Jonathan until much later. I was certainly aware of him.
Yeah. What else? You mentioned Rosenzweig. Did you ever
I that? Never ate her food. No, I did, actually. I and a bunch of other chefs, a chef friend took over Vanessa right after she left. I was working in the same company. Now, this was back in... 80s, and I'll never forget. Now, back then, you know, you were a woman chef. You were not surrounded by sisters. I remember walking in that restaurant, and the staff, what was left, were all hardcore Mexican dudes, like the fucking mountains, not guys used to being told what to do by a woman.
Yeah.
They were like... Anne says this, Anne did it this way, and this, and that. They were fucking absolutely worshipful and respectful of her work. I made a real impression on her.
Hmm.
And of course, you know how early she was there.
Yeah.
And how, you know, that must have been tough.
Yeah.
Kicking ass and taking names back in the day.
Yeah. The whole drug element of life in this business in New York at that time.
Yeah.
I just love to talk about it for a minute. I always feel like this is a misunderstood thing. I feel like the... I mean, I'm sure there are people who just did it because they like doing it or they had a problem. It seems to me like the hours, the pressure, the logistics almost of that, of the profession, are almost tailor-made to lead to this. When you finish a day,
look,
I don't know. This is, people have made comments along those lines to me.
From what I've seen, those days are largely over. The culture I grew up in, until the latter part of my career,
mm-hmm.
until early 90s, if you wanted to, you know, chef, I'm going to go smoke a joint and walk in, that's cool. Chef, I got a package. Or I got a package coming in 15 minutes, want a bump. Now, you know, hey, chef, I got some coke coming. You're fucking fired. You're a liability.
Yeah.
And in fact, if chef hears that you're, as soon as you finish work, you're going out to staying up all night snorting coke, he's thinking about, you know, first time you're late, first time something goes missing in the changing room, you're a liability now. You're going to bring the side down.
Yeah.
We didn't really have to worry about bringing the side down so much. And a lot of us were in the business from the get-go, remember, to get high, to be in a world where there were always somebody with a package. There were always girls who liked somebody with a package.
Mm-hmm.
You could always smoke a joint with your buddies in the fucking locker room, in the walk-in.
Was that the world that you guys inherited, or was that something that started to happen?
It's a world I walked into.
It was that way when you got there.
And I remember in the 70s, certainly, you know, everybody thought cocaine was fine. It wasn't addicting. It wasn't going to hurt you. It made you smart. Woke you up. You'd had a couple of cocktails and bring you around. So there were plenty of really, back then, there were plenty of really super talented chefs. So we know a bunch of them who had cocaine problems.
Yeah.
But everybody knows better now.
Right.
I don't think there's anybody out there running multi-unit quality restaurant organization that you or I would care to eat at any one of those restaurants who's got a coke problem.
Right.
You can't. We well know that.
Right.
And by a coke problem, I mean not only they're not doing coke regularly or even much, if at all, but they're not accepting cocaine use in their kitchen. It's certainly not. You're not smoking a joint. You're not smoking a cigarette.
Yeah.
I know a lot of kitchens now, they don't even want smokers.
Sure.
It's different, a whole different world. Plus, they're all open kitchens.
Right.
But the culture's changed. With that change in prestige and interest, behavior had to shape up, and it did.
Yeah. What about from the customer side back in those days?
Drugs, I mean?
Yeah.
Customers.
No, I mean, I've heard stories
we know what they did in the bathroom because we'd see the bathrooms at the end of the night.
Right.
They'd fuck on the sink. They'd do rails off every horizontal surface.
Right.
I wouldn't know. I don't know what they get up to out there other than what they do to the bathroom.
The chefs start getting famous. You know, Jeremiah had that big Doers ad campaign. Right. And do you remember when that first started to register for you?
The civilian started, you know, wanted to fuck the chef. That was a first, or that was new. Just by virtue of the fact that you cooked.
You made a connection between
and
one
and
the
other. You'd see the coverage in the
people
papers.
People on the cover of New York Magazine.
Yeah, just the way people talked about chefs was different. Suddenly they were sexy.
Yeah.
No one ever said that before. I mean, we knew we smelled bad. We were dirty, smelled bad,
right.
And were bad. Generally, the last person in the world you wanted to be in a relationship with.
Yeah. How about being in New York, how much were you at the time aware of what was going on? I mean, I guess in the mid-late 80s, let's say, when these other things come under radar. How much are you aware of what's going on elsewhere in the country?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I read
Chippenny, the names. Stars, Michaels, all
I read
that
about
stuff.
It in Food Arts.
That was it.
That was it. Zero.
I mean, mine.
I'd say that hasn't. Look, unless you're at the level, if you're a hardworking cook in a kitchen right now, unless you're making enough money that you can take a few weeks off here and there and eat around the country, as a growing number, very large number of people have. You don't know what's going on in these places. You know your kitchen. You know the kitchens you worked in, and maybe a few friends' kitchens.
Yeah.
You don't have, you know, you're not doing wine tours of Napa Valley, chances are.
No, but I just mean, like, I think...
I wasn't aware at all.
I mean, today, right, we're sitting here, but we know who Sean Brock is. I mean, there's such a...
Well, I do, but, you know, that's because I'm on TV.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think
that's because, you know, I met Sean making a TV show in Charleston.
Right.
I went drinking with him without even knowing he was Sean Brock, actually.
Yeah.
We were doing a show, and it was like, hey, this local cook dude.
Yeah.
We've since become friends. But
yeah.
No, I didn't know. I didn't know. I was fucking clueless. I mean, not that I would have let you know that. If you interviewed me in 95, I would have pretended to know all of these people, of course.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, but I didn't. I hadn't been anywhere. I'd never been there. I don't think I'd ever been to San Francisco. I hadn't been anywhere. Until 2001.
Is that right? Right after the book?
I'd been in France. I'd been to, as a kid, I'd been to the Caribbean. That was it. I've never owned a car.
Yeah. When the whole Blue Ribbon thing started, were you part of that scene or not?
Not part of the scene. I mean, I went, but I didn't know anyone there. I mean, nobody was inviting me to their table. I knew Scott Bryan. So...
How'd you guys meet?
John Tizar introduced us.
Okay.
Because they used to work together out on the island. They were all part of that. I think they were all part of that Long Island Mafia.
Yeah.
Briefly. But I was introduced by Tizar to Scott Bryan, and at various points, look, me and my cooks loved Scott's food, and wherever Scott was working, we'd all run over there. Often we'd call him up, order food. If our kitchens closed at the same time, we'd call him up, order food, and then like close down real quick and run over there and sit at the bar and eat. You know. We all really, really respected what he did. So I think, Scott introduced me to, you know, young Mario, who was at Lupa at Depot at the time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have met all these guys otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, Scott was somebody that other chefs knew and respected.
Yeah.
Whereas I was, I was a hacker.
Yeah. Okay. That might be good for me.
Cool.
Thank you.
Okay, so the slight silver lining to all that is I think he actually did meet Keith Richards, ultimately, who was on his hit list of... Yeah.
That would have been...
I'm told they actually did meet eventually.
Do you know where he hangs out? He hangs out...
Keith Richards?
Keith Richards is in Weston, Connecticut.
What?
Yes.
Okay.
Look it up. He has a house there. And his wife's sister has a place, Luke's.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
I had no idea.
Many, many, many people have run into him. He plays Chinese checkers at Luke's.
He's become an old English gentleman.
Yep.
As has Mick Jagger. Until they get on stage.
Happy to have photographs. I know so many people who have just hit up Keith.
Yeah.
For a photo in front of the Chinese checkers board.
Wow. Well, that's our show for this week. Julia, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Andrew.
Jeet Paul, thanks for helping me clean up the audio, which I hope you were able to do something with the restaurant noise. I think it was worth it. Everybody listening, I don't know what it was like for you. For me, when I remember that I had this audio and listen, I can't watch Parts Unknown yet. I can't watch it.
I haven't watched
it. I can't watch it. And when I heard his voice,
yeah,
that voice,
yeah,
he was blessed with a voice that was perfect for who he became. I don't think it gets talked about enough. You could not train someone to have a voice like that. It was so... It just summed up everything about his life. It was so him. It was perfect. Yeah. I hope this was something that... I'll just say that you've all got something from out there. I think most people who listen to this show are cooks or chefs or culinary students or people who are interested in that world. And nobody, I think... brought it to life on the page, increased the appreciation for it, increased the appreciation just for the work. Mm. If you think back to what you just listened to, how much time did he spend talking about just the rigors of the life and also the glories of the life? It's what I love.
The glories.
The glories. It's what I... Do you miss those things?
I do. I do.
You do, right? It's always there.
Yeah, there was a sense, there were things as a writer that you will never have that you had as a cook.
Yeah, all right. I also have to thank a chef, Dave DeBerry, for letting us borrow the dining room of his cookery restaurant at the very last second, probably within moments of when... I got you right before you went to bed. We got Dave right when he woke up.
Yeah.
And that's it. So all of you out there in podcast land, thanks so much for listening. If you want to keep up with this show, the best way to do that is simply to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify. Or to follow our Instagram feed. Again, the handle is @chefpodcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.